This is part 5 of Paul's review of Sepulcher's visits to the United States in 2013.
Now let's go and focus on these hugelkultur beds that were built. So I'm not exactly, you know, the moment that they started fooling with it, I sat like a good 100 yards away from the project, and I'm waiting for my ride, who's leaving any minute now, to take me back. And it's like, I got to get off this site. I'm just getting way too angry. And this is not the Paul Wheaton show. This is the Sepulcher show. So I just need to go away. And so I went away. I came back. And, you know, because they have the dinner thing in the evenings. And the guy that was doing the cooking was really good. That was some good food.
He was awesome. He was really
good. Yeah. Tony. His name is Tony.
I got to say, we had great catering this whole trip. That is one thing. Oh, man. I mean, the food was excellent. Every meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner, it was great.
Yeah, yeah. And I visited with Tony quite a bit. And he's done some of that stuff where he's cooking for, like, in Montana, there's apparently, like, something country club-esque where it costs $250,000 a year to be a member of something, and then he would cook for these people. It's like then they, you know, they had a kitchen, and so then basically these people were paying, you know, enormous amounts of money to be part of this, which included the food.
Right.
But I guess the big thing is that it keeps the riffraff out. You know, riffraff don't have $250,000 a year to be part of whatever this is. I can't remember what they called this country clubbish thing, but he was talking about cooking for extremely freakishly rich people.
Uh-huh.
And the quality of his food was amazing. And he's definitely a foodie to the core. And he was talking about different foods that he's, you know, been working with and like where he got it from and the story behind it and things like that. That could be a podcast in itself. But, so I came back. And I looked at the hugelkultur beds, and it's like I was really disappointed. And so there's basically what they did was is that they had these two really small hugelkultur-ish beds, and they were surrounded by deer fence. So it's a place to put this stuff in and you know, raise some things, and it was protected. And it's right next to the creek.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a big downside at putting in your hugelkultur beds right next to a creek. And that is that this is the low spot in the land. That's why there's water flowing there. Water tends to not flow naturally on the high spot on your land. It tends to flow at the lowest spot.
Right.
So this is effectively a frost pocket. And so my first thought was, and this is one of the reasons why I needed to leave, is that look, we're going to build hugelkultur beds in a frost pocket. And this is, and Sepp's the one directing it. And it's like, really? And I'm thinking like, you know what? I would build it much closer to the house. And I would build it someplace, you know, that's up away from the creek. And then I would even go so far as like if there's any cold air mass movement to direct it away from my hugelkultur beds if possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be considerate of where the cold air flows and to not put it in a frost pocket.
Mm-hmm.
But they did. They built these two hugelkultur beds in a frost pocket. The next thing is that they built these two hugelkultur beds really close to each other in parallel. So that once they're full of shrubs and trees and things like that, you're not going to be able to walk between the two of them. And on top of that, it's built in such a way that it will make a frost pocket even worse than the frost pocket that's already there.
Because that's sort of horseshoe design?
Yeah. Kind of like what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Don't make your sun traps on a north-facing slope.
Right.
All right. So the other thing is that I thought that the height of the beds, the overall height was about 4 feet. I would have preferred to see hugelkultur beds 6 feet or taller.
Yeah, they're definitely smaller than the ones we built in Montana last year. But I still think it was a good learning experience as far as the demonstration. I agree with you. I think they could have been placed in a better position. But it was a good demonstration of how to do it as far as, you know, getting the basic understanding of, you know, how you mulch it, how you plant it, how you, you know, protect the soil from blowing away by putting the branches with the natural nails, all that kind of stuff. And you know, maybe Sepp was thinking, I don't know, I can't speak for him, maybe he was thinking that the extra warmth generated by the, you know, composting material in the hugel bed would more than compensate for the frost pocket or whatever. I don't know. But, you know, it's a point well taken. I think I would have personally maybe picked a different spot, too. It was, though, relatively close to the house. I don't think it was more than, I don't know. Do you remember? Maybe like 40 yards away. It didn't seem like it was that far away.
It was it was more than 100 yards away.
Was it? Okay. So, I mean, maybe like, I'm thinking of...
You've kind of moved into zone 3.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know what? I think having hugel culture beds in zone 3 is great after you're done building your hugel culture beds in zones 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So, all right, and then the last item, this is an error that I made in the past. And so, you know, and it's just one of those things where I kind of would have thought that Sepp, you know, being far more advanced than I am, would have not made this error. And that is that there was a lot of sticks sticking out of the top. And the thinking is it's like, oh, then, you know, you've got, like, pole beans will go up these sticks.
Yeah, like a natural trellis.
Other viney kinds of things will use these sticks as trellisy things and stuff like that. So, which is a wonderful thought, a good thing to think about. But it turns out that there's a problem, and that is that the sticks will also wick water out of the hugel culture bed.
Mm.
And
even dead sticks like that?
What's that?
I said even I thought those sticks were dead that they used.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sticks. Dead sticks. I mean, dead sticks are what we use in the hugel culture. All they got to do is get wet, and then the top part of the stick dries out, and then it wicks water out. It just keeps wicking the water up. And so then basically this is a point of being able to desiccate the hugel culture bed. So that's not good. That's not a feature. But that's a minor point compared to the other points.
Mm-hmm. You know, somebody brought up, I remember you saying that, I remember you mentioned something about that while we were there. And then there was another lady there that had mentioned that, hey, you ought to be careful because we get some pretty strong winds whipping across here, and I'm worried that the winds might actually knock over those sticks. And Seth didn't seem too concerned about it, but, you know, who knows? I haven't been in Bozeman in the winter. I know it can be pretty rough, but and maybe in winter, you know, the vegetation's died off a lot, and so that's less of an issue. You're not really blocking the wind as much, but I thought that was worthy of consideration. And she's a local
so now,
resident, but no.
That was actually when I first arrived to the property. I mean, you know that there's a lot of wind, just because they say the amount of moisture is the same as Missoula, but the landscape there looked a lot like Great Falls, where it's like hardly any trees are growing. I mean, the only trees that are growing are ones where they're being babied.
Right.
And,
it's a big and so open, dry of, valley.
Yeah. So
plains almost, like just, not a lot of, very few. And it's interesting because you look up on the mountains and there's so much water up there and so much on the mountain ranges surrounding Bozeman, but the valley below is pretty doggone dry.
So my observation is that even though while we're there, there wasn't very much wind, my observation is that I'll bet you that there's a lot of wind here, even if it isn't blowing right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the wind is desiccating the area, drying it out, and that's why we don't see a lot of other growth here right now on this property or any of the nearby properties.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would think that, you know, one of the earliest things that I would do would be to put in berms, especially like if we're going to go walk down and hang out down by the road, which we did a lot of, I'd say one of the things I'd want to do is to put a great big old berm up right next to the road, like 15 feet tall, and even bring it in up the sides of the property a little bit just to kind of make the property be a little bit more of a sanctuary and a little bit less of a property next to a busy paved road.
Yeah, less visible.
Yeah. Well, and it's not even so much visible, but yeah, you know, it that way you have less of a view of cars and trucks going up and down the road, but it's quieter. You can be 50 feet away from the road, and even if cars, if eight cars go by, you don't even hear them.
Right. Nothing like Earth for blocking the noise.
Exactly. So, on the other hand, since it's the downhill side, you would have to take steps to mitigate creating a frost pocket. But still, there's things that you can do to kind of make it so that way you're you know, eliminating. This is the same thing for we talked about for your property up near Dayton.
Right. But having that berm and setting the trees on top of it.
Yeah. And so, but up near the house, I think you would especially like, okay, I'm going to put in some hugelkultur beds here. It's like, I think it would be wise to put in a couple of big berms just so that the wind doesn't dry out your hugelkultur beds so much. Because, and this is the same thing that I also recommended in the podcast that I did in Great Falls. You need to put a great big old berm around the perimeter of your property to cut the wind. And this is exactly what Sepp Holzer said for that ridgetop garden at Sage Mountain. And it's exactly what Sepp Holzer said for the property in Dayton in order to cut down the wind.
Yeah, I remember that, actually. I remember you talking about, especially the Great Falls one. And I think even another lady who was at your event there had talked about, oh, that was such a game changer, you know, because they have some serious winds there. So, yeah, I have to agree with you. I don't know. I can't comment on why that wasn't done. Maybe that's part of the future design, and we were only doing phase one just to get some immediate production and, you know, take advantage of, hey, we're coming into summer months. Let's do this now. But, you know, I think he did create a kind of a master plan for the landowner, and maybe that was a part of the master plan. Hey, we'll do this now while I'm here, but, you know, you should really build some berms here to block the wind, because I know that's been a big part of his sort of message when it comes to building hugel beds and all the factors you take into consideration. That has been a part of it.
Now, your point was that the woman was concerned about the sticks sticking out of the top of the hugelkultur because they could get blown out because of the wind. My point is that because of the wind, the wind is going to dry those wet sticks faster, and they're going to dry out those little hugelkultur beds much faster.
Right.
So the desiccation is going to happen much faster. So those are like big desiccating rods. The wind will hit them and dry out that hugelkultur bed.
Right.
So so now I guess for me the big thing was is that I think that if this was Jeff Lawton there and Jeff Lawton had done these things, mm-hmm. I could have communicated with Jeff Lawton in English, and I think that the design would have been improved. Because I think I could be persuasive to Jeff Lawton. Jeff Lawton respects my work. I'm not sure if – I mean, Sepp Holzer, when he talks about me being the most important permaculture guy or the best permaculture guy in the United States or whatever. I'm not sure what exactly – I mean, I only hear about it from the translator, so I don't really know exactly what he has to say. And he's never said it while I'm there. I just hear about it like, oh, he was talking about you yesterday, and he said, mom, yum, yum. And it's like, so okay, he has some respect for my stuff, but it seems like every time I try to enter into a dialogue with him, it goes nowhere. So it's whereas I feel like I would have liked to have had him, if he could speak English and he respects my opinion, we could have talked about the pond thing. Look, just build a smaller pond. And then everybody will, and that's the way you go about it, you know? And that's the way it's done here. And if you're worried about kickback from it, put a big berm there between the pond and that house over there, so that way no one objects.
Right.
And then shouldn't we be talking about putting some berms up to mitigate the wind issues? Hey, those hugelkultur beds you're about to build down there, I think that's a frost pocket, you know? Hey, You think we should move it? You know, and I think I could have, but it's like, you know what? Dialogue was pretty much not allowed. So I didn't get to say these things. And so it's like I ended up just getting horribly frustrated and so I left. So when we're talking, I wish I could have dialogue with Sepulcher. I wish I could. And sometimes it kind of seems like I can. So like when I was at your house, and then later also when I was at Katarina's house and we did part two, of trying to tell him about what is a rocket mass heater, it took forever. And it went from like, you know, that we've talked about this before. It went from like, no, it's impossible, to yes, he's invented it already. And it's kind of like it was a long, painful struggle to, and that's the closest thing I've ever had to dialogue. And again, that
just goes back, I think, to that challenge with the language barrier. It's you're always going to lose something in translation, even with the best translator, and there's always the chance that he's going to misunderstand what you're saying, because different things have different meanings. So I think that's a big part of it, because I will say this in Seth's defense. He really took a lot of time at each of the events to have Q&A sessions. Right. And again, it's the same challenge. Even with the Q&A session, sometimes it's hard to convey the right meaning. That happened in one case where one guy, Joshua, was given his design, and Seth misunderstood what he was saying, and it took some clarification. And then once, so he was kind of being critical of the design initially, but once he understood what he was saying, he was like, oh, okay, no, I take it back. Yeah, this is actually good. I see what you're talking about now. So there's always going to be some of that. So actually, that's one of the challenges of, you know, dealing with someone with a different language, that you wouldn't have that issue with a Jeff Lawton. But you can still...
I think half of it is language stuff, and then the other half is like that stuff I talked about in podcast 111, where it's like he's just had such a parade of idiots go by that he doesn't want to have dialogue anymore. And I think another part of it is it just seemed like, you know, he seemed to want to... And you know, I've mentioned this, and it's like it bothers me so much. It seems like he wanted to like get into a fight with me or something, and sometimes he wanted to have a good time, and sometimes it's like, come on, let's wrestle, you know. And it's like and at the same time, I kind of feel like I don't want to turn this into the Paul Wheaton show. At the same time, I kind of feel like, you know, can we talk about putting this in a Frost pocket? And I kind of felt like, you know what? He's in a weird mood. I don't want to touch him with a 10-foot pole. And I suppose that if other people raise the question, hey, why are we building this in a Frost pocket? Maybe he would have changed it. But I think that's another thing too, is once he gets started, I don't think he's going to change his mind once he gets started. So.
Yeah, that's you know, that could be the case. I don't know. I can't speak for Sep on those issues, but again, I think a lot of it. I think most of it comes down to just translation issues and understanding. It's so much easier to communicate with someone in your own language, and there's so much less of a chance of misunderstanding certain things. And I think also one other thing is that sometimes, you know, in the middle of a seminar, you're kind of in the zone and you're already kind of like in fourth gear and you're cruising, and you know, to answer that question might cause you to have to downshift back to first gear or second gear, and then you have to regain your momentum. I think sometimes he's just like, hey, let's press forward, save that question for later.
Yeah.
He didn't do that, too. And it's not, he's not, it may come across like he's blowing off your question, but really, he just wants to stay focused on what we're doing now, get it accomplished. And then, you know, usually at the end of the day in these workshops is when we have a Q&A time, where anything that was taught during the day or taught during the workshop or came up that hasn't been answered, hey, now's the time to ask me. But if he's in the middle of something, you know, he's less likely to entertain, you know, additional questions when he's right in the middle of something.
Right. So I you know, I think a big part of it now is that this brilliant genius man has, I hereby grant him all the license in the world to be curmudgeon-y. And I cannot help but think that this guy's been through so much shit that it's like I you know, he's going to be, I think as a result, he's going to be extra curmudgeon-y. And so it I feel like the amount of knowledge that this guy has that I want to have in my head is immense, is tremendous. And I went and I used 7 days of my life to gain 5 days worth of knowledge, and I feel like I walked away with just that one little speck of tidbit about, you know, don't be drinking the water that comes off the roof too much. And that was it. And I kind of feel like the amount of education that I get per day at this point for me is small, and it makes me very sad. Because he is the man. And I wish there was, so, and it's like, I don't know whether it's the state of our personal relationship or whatever. I do think that people can still go to learn a lot. I did get a lot of feedback from a lot of people that were very disappointed in the Bozeman event. And they were excited to have met him and to shake his hand and to witness his powerful enthusiasm. And at the same time, they felt like they were walking away with not much. I kind of feel like it's possible that in the future that the Holzer agroecology team are going to be the real educators. And that hopefully when somebody gets to the point that they're certified, like Holzer certified, that maybe Holzer will have a far more open conversation with those people that, you know, that I'm not able to have. And so those will be the people that we will really be learning from about Holzer's stuff in the future, is my guess. Maybe also from his son Josef. Josef, there's a new video with Josef giving a tour of the Parameterhof, and Josef is clearly really good at this.
Yeah,
and has
yeah.
really come into his space. So maybe, and I did feel like for a lot of the things 4 years ago when Josef was here, that there were a lot of things where, you know, Sepp would say something, and I would then go to Josef and say, he said this, and Josef would be like, yeah, not exactly, you know? It's a little bit more like this, actually.
Yeah.
And Josef speaks English.
Yeah. And I think that, honestly, Paul, I think that's the biggest barrier. I mean, to your point, the Holzer agroecology team, we all, you know, I mean, the Austrians are already all certified. We're almost certified. And there is going to be a lot, especially the low-level stuff, the blocking and tackling, fundamental stuff. I think in the future that is going to be taught by the Holzer agroecology team that have been through this training. And we'll teach us techniques, but we'll do it in English. There'll be more time for questions. There'll be more interactive dialogue. And we're kind of focused on that for two reasons. Number one, people will understand it better. Number two, there'll be the expense of the events will be a lot less because we won't have to pay Sepp and fly him over. Number three, Sepp's time is becoming so much more elusive because he's doing so many major projects around the world, big stuff, gigantic projects, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars even compared to the little pittance thing that we're doing, that his time is going to become maybe more exclusively reserved for the real master classes and for the really advanced stuff and the big projects. And that's, you know, that's maybe a challenge that you might have because you're so intelligent and educated on this stuff anyway to begin with that part of the reason that maybe you didn't learn as much this last go-around is because you already know so much and you've been, you know, with Sepp on so many occasions in the past and attended his events that a lot of stuff that was new to you 4 years ago is now, you know, you're very familiar with. So if we could really bring in our big gun, Sepp Holzer, for the events where we're doing something like a real master class, like we're going to build a lake, we're going to go detail how to seal it, you know, how you compress the earth, how you dig the dam and compress it with clay, and here's the things to look out for, and then save the simple stuff like building a hugel bed or here's how you do a terrace, save that for his instructors so we can kind of make the best use of Sepp's time and utilize him to the best capabilities. So I think those are all things we're looking at. In fact, we've got a conference call on Friday, I think, to go through some of that. So, you know, to that point, again, and it also, I think, finally, it goes back to the issue that we talked about yesterday with Jack, is that, you know, everybody comes in at a different knowledge and experience level. There were people that came up to me after Bozeman and said, this was incredible. I learned so much. It was amazing. And I said, oh, it's great. I'm happy to hear that. You know, what's your level of experience? Oh, well, I've only been studying permaculture for a short time, but, you know, I've been a gardener for a while, versus guys like you that have been doing this for years and years, and you've got a ton of experience, both, you know, intellectually and practical experience. I mean, your 80 acres you had in Mount Spokane was your little Kraveterhof. And so you've actually done this practically as well. So that's going to be one of the challenges moving forward, is how do we make this event, you know, how do we make sure people get the most out of it regardless of their skill set and regardless of their past experience? You know, and maybe we end up separating kind of a beginner course to an intermediate to an advanced, you know, and something like you've been through the beginner and intermediate, and so maybe more an advanced course would be something where, you know, we're teaching calculus, you know, permaculture-wise, as opposed to addition and subtraction. So, you know, those are all things that's good feedback, and I'll definitely take it back to the rest of the team, and it's something that we'll definitely address, because we want to make sure we give people their money's worth and they get the most meat out of it. So, points well taken.
The people that said that they were, you know, disappointed, I suspect that it might be that all of the people that were disappointed, and I haven't, like, looked this up or anything like that or verified it, I suspect that it's possible that each of the people that were disappointed have listened to all of my podcasts. And so then that would include the 21 podcast review of Sepp's permaculture book, which included me sharing a lot of information about my past experience with Sepp.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the podcasts that were made at the SEP event to convey, like, all the things that we learned, all the things that we witnessed, and stuff like that. So, and of course, you know, all the things about SEP that we've been talking about in podcasts for years now. So I think that people that have listened to all these podcasts then will go to an event like this, and they're already familiar with so much of this stuff.
Right.
But Sepp pretty much presents in such a way that he assumes that all the people in the room have never heard of him before.
Yeah, and that's a valid point. That's something we have to address. You know, I look back at this workshop, and there were different, you know, strengths and challenges on each one of them. I think overall it was a big success. I've got a lot of positive feedback. There were definitely some things, though, that were frustrating to us and to SEP, you know, as far as some of the permits and stuff we would have liked to have done. But I think it's a good point you make, and I think moving forward we definitely have to figure out a way that we understand the audience, and there's an expectation level set in advance. Like, here's what we're going to cover, and if you're already proficient in these areas, maybe you ought to wait till the next one when we cover things that you're not familiar with yet. And, you know, again, that's something we're definitely going to address and talk about on Friday.
So, and which, of course, SEP doesn't do that. So,
no, but we'll actually come up with a game plan, and then we'll go back to Sepp and say, okay, next time we bring you back, we'd like to focus on this, this, and this, because these are people that are more advanced. They're familiar with the basic concepts, and, you know, and or they've listened to all Pod's podcasts, and they're, you know, they've read your book, and so let's jump right into the calculus as opposed to the addition and subtraction.
Right, right. Okay, setting that aside, the next item I've got on my list is to say, I am not Holzer certified. So I thought I'd asked around a little bit, and there was like this requirement of 30 days, and it's like, wow, you know, it turns out that my last day in Bozeman, that would be 30 days. So on the last day in Bozeman, was it the last day, or no, it was the next to the last day. It was the next to the last day. They had some sort of event or something, some sort of a banquet.
Yes, actually at the guy who did all the catering. It was at a place that he works out of, and that was a really cool, awesome dinner, as always. And yeah. Some of the people that attended the event got a chance to go up and kind of share projects they're working on or what they learned, or, you know, their idea design based on what they learned during the week. Here's how I would design my property. And so that was kind of cool to give the people there a chance to interact and kind of share with what they've learned. So...
So I tried to ask before the event happened, and of course I'm talking to the Holzer agroecology people, and I'm saying, like, okay, well, you know, I guess I think I've met the requirements. Did I meet the requirements? And it just, I don't know where it went from there. And so I don't know, maybe I haven't, there's something I haven't done or whatever, but I thought that it, somehow I had this idea that it's like no one said I didn't. And so I'm not sure what to think now. I, you know, no one's contacted me and say, now you're certified. No one's done that, and no one has contacted me to say, oh, in order to complete your certification, you have to do these last two little things or something like that. Which I can't imagine what more I could possibly need to be doing. But so I'm kind of like I'm a little concerned about that space of, like, you know. But on the other hand, it's like I don't feel like I need to be Holzer certified, but I also kind of feel like I thought that that was it, 30 days. I think that there was something else, 30 days, and you, part of it is you have to do a thing.
Yeah, it's like kind of maybe. A final exam, more or less, with SEP, you know? Just like a guy getting his PhD, you got to stand before the four or five, you know, other guys with PhDs and defend your thesis. It's kind of a similar thing where you would design your property, but definitely as far as the 30 days, you've done that. I mean, I think, like you said, the last day of Bozeman was your 30th day. And also, you know, Holzer Agroecology was formed late last year, so, and Perma Vitae, you know, last, I think it has been around a couple years, but part of this is we're, you know, finalizing this curriculum, and you had already been going to SEP events, you know, 4 or 5 years ago when he was in Washington. So that'll definitely be taken into consideration. And I think in your case, we'll have to verify this with the team, but you've already completed, I mean, you're so far ahead of the average student, and this is kind of your full-time gig too, is studying and learning about this stuff and sharing all that great information with the rest of us on the website. But I think, you know, your final thing, I think all that SEP would require is just, hey, come on up, sit down for 15 minutes and show me like a design plan for, you know, say, for example, the new land you're building. Here's what I want to do. Here's a this and that. And as long as you can show that you've, you know, thought it through and you've got principles, everybody's a different artist. But as long as you can show the fundamental basics, you know, I would definitely think that you would, you would get that certification and in fact far surpass it with your level of knowledge. So but that's something I'll look into for you with the team and get back to you on shortly.
So for somebody listening right now and they're saying, I want to put, you know Holzer certification on my resume or whatever, then what is the deal? Do you know what exactly the deal is?
I don't know exactly the deal because we're still putting it in writing, but I can give you the broad outline. It's in some of this is, again, is what we're going to finalize tomorrow. We had the chance to bring SEP over here for this workshop, but there were so many logistics and things that went along with that we thought, let's get this thing done first, and then as soon as we're finished with this tour, we'll definitely put it in writing, and it'll be concrete exactly what has to take place, and we'll make sure we publish that and disseminate that all information to everybody. But the broad sketch would be, it would be 30 days with SEP or SEP certified instructors, and there's going to be certain projects that will have to be completed. At least one will have to be a waterworks type of thing, lake and pond building, hydrology. It'll be hugel beds and those types of things. So it'll be more concrete, and that'll be forthcoming probably in the next like 2 weeks or so. As I mentioned, we're talking Friday. That's one of the things on the dock is to go through that and get that out. And it will be like an official certification. So you're kind of in a special case because, you know, you've actually been working with SEP Holzer, you know, longer than some of the Holzer agroecology team and or Perma Vitae team. So you're kind of a unique, you know, one-off case, I think. But that information will be coming out shortly, and it will be concrete and specific. So it's definitely open to anybody who wants to just learn about one specific aspect. They can come to the workshop that addresses that aspect. And or somebody wants to get the full certification, maybe they're a full-time designer practitioner and just wants to add that level of you know, recognized proficiency, then that'll be something that'll be available to them as well.
All right. So the next thing is that and this is the last item I've got on my list. And that is that I got to tell you, I'm not a big greenhouse fan. However, Zach, when it comes to greenhouses in general, Zach is like some of the work that he's been involved in is way out ahead of nearly any other greenhouse person I've met.
He's amazing. Yeah, yeah, Zach is he's incredible. His greenhouse designs are brilliant, and he's built so many of them. I told him this summer, I said, man, I want to work with you on one of these projects. You don't have to pay me. I'll come stuff bags just so I can learn the technology because I think it's so cool. And I'm kind of, you know, I understand your position on the greenhouses, but I do think there's definitely a place for it, particularly for someone who isn't as proficient in, let's say, a lot of permaculture broad acre techniques as you are, and or someone that just lives in a really rough climate. You know, the guy Vic I mentioned yesterday in Fairbanks, anybody in Zone 3, northern Minnesota, northern Michigan, these are areas where I kind of look at it as a belt and suspenders approach where you can do your broad acre permaculture stuff. But having the greenhouse is kind of like the belt and suspenders. You've got another layer of security, another layer of redundancy where you can do some things that just makes things easier. You know, whether it's starting seeds earlier or whether it's growing stuff all year round, like the greenhouse that we toured that was the guy that, his name escapes me off the top of my head, but it was Zach's mentor that he learned a lot from. You know, and/or create a design like that, or like the design that Zach built actually at the property in Bozeman, which was amazing, and incorporated a lot of your kind of technologies that you brought to the surface, like the rocket mass heater as an option to help heat it, you know, and also using, you know, Mike Ayler-esque type of technologies, Wafati type technologies of planting that greenhouse deeper in the ground to use thermal heat and the natural temperature of the earth to help regulate it, you know, that combined with rocket mass heaters. So it's really state-of-the-art stuff. And, you know, and on a further note, you know, we were talking earlier about being self-sufficient or having, you know, be able to afford a place off the grid somewhere. I mean, with Zach's greenhouse designs, a lot of them have a, you know, a house on the back of it, or at least a studio apartment equivalent, where you've got a room, a kitchen, a place to live. And that is basically, I think Zach had mentioned to me, and I don't want to quote, you know, there's obviously variables, but I think the greenhouse that he had built, which basically was a house and a greenhouse together with all the dirt and levels of terracing and levels of, you know, the irrigation system and the, you know, the rocket mass heater and the thermal heat and all that, it was a house too with, where he would live behind that. I think the total cost for all of it was like $40,000. So, you know, not a lot of places you can get a house like that where you could grow your own food in any weather for $40,000. So that to me, it just opens up a lot of interesting possibilities. And that also for me was a highlight of the event.
So I do think that there, in fact, I asked, all right. So Zach wanted me to come and look at both greenhouses. And actually, the one that was the older one that his mentor runs is the one I was interested in seeing, because they do a lot of work with having having an ecosystem going in there. So
right.
So they work very hard at growing some tropical stuff on subtropical stuff, and in Montana. But they're very concerned about an ecosystem. Make sure that there's, you know, the appropriate pollinators in there, and make sure that things are being grown in polycultures and stuff like that. So it's quite a bit different from your traditional greenhouse of like, oh, let's grow food in rows under, you know, a cover.
Right.
And
right.
We'll heat it and stuff. And so they're not doing that. In fact, I never asked about whether it was directly heated and how they heat it and stuff like that. But one of the things I told Zach is like, okay, you know what? I like the idea of observing that one just because I like the idea of it's an ecosystem.
Right.
Plus, they kept talking about the frogs, and it's like, ooh, I'd like to go see the frogs. And then it's like with the other one, where it's the one that he built, I said, and he's like, oh, we're going to do a little tour. We're going to have, like, everybody's going to go up and look at it and stuff like that. Why? I want you to come along. I said, I don't mind looking at it maybe another time, but if you got me coming up there, then it's like I could try to just be quiet. And he's like, no, I want to hear what you have to say. It's like, dude, I don't want to bash your shit. And so he's like, no, it'll be good. And it's like, all right, so I go, and so you're like, it cost only $40,000, and I'm kind of thinking,
Well, I have to give that caveat. That was for like the house and the greenhouse together as one.
Well,
and that was a big greenhouse where you're talking a full functioning ecosystem in there with trees, with, you know, smaller crops. I mean, that was the Mac Daddy. I mean, last year in Dayton, I know Zach helped build that the structure that we actually used to hold the events. And I remember asking him, how much would a greenhouse, just a pure greenhouse, not, you know, even with the rocket mass heater or the fancy house attached to it, how much would it cost to build a greenhouse just like this, you know, with parts and labor, just a basic greenhouse, start my seedlings or maybe grow some stuff, extend the growing season? And I think he said that was more like $8,000. So the one he showed us was definitely the Rolls Royce, the Bentley of greenhouses. But my point is, if you're looking at a house that's more than $40,000, why not build one of those that you get a house and a giant greenhouse where you can grow your food in one place?
So let's talk about the size of the greenhouse. I think it was about 10 to 12 feet wide and 25 feet long. Does that sound about right to you? The one that he built.
Say that again, 25 feet long and how wide?
About 10 to 12 feet wide.
I would say more like 15 feet wide and more like 30 feet long.
Because now I remember we're kind of, he's got two paths in there, and people are trying to stand on the paths, and it seemed a little crowded, you know. That's why I'm kind of thinking like I'm about 10 feet, maybe a little wider than 10 feet wide.
Well, remember, also there was the living quarters that was behind that wall of the greenhouse.
Right. I'm going to get to that in a minute.
Okay.
I'll get to that in a moment. But for the moment, I'm just thinking like, okay, for the greenhouse space, and he used a lot of cement, so it was rather cement-esque. And he also talked about like the soil goes down yay far, and there's like a layer of insulation down there. And then he also talked about the soil depth gets deeper on one end than at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that you feel it's like 15 by 30. I'm going to be generous and say, I think it's 12 by 25 or 12 by 24, something like that. I'm sure, you know, Zach will be happy to provide the exact dimensions. But yeah, so that gives the pod people a vague idea of about how big it is.
Yeah.
Then there's the living thing behind that, which we didn't see on the tour, but from what I was able to tell, it wasn't very big. It's definitely might be a quarter of the size of the big space, maybe a third.
Yeah, I think it's
right?
The equivalent of like a studio apartment or something.
I'm thinking tiny house, you know, something pretty small.
Yeah.
And it's like so that gives you an idea. I thought his implementation of a rocket mass heater was interesting. I made some suggestions about how to improve the existing design that he had. But the one thing it doesn't have is it doesn't, like an Ehler structure, he has that trench. And I think that trench that Ehler has is really important. So I visited with him a little bit about the trench, and it seems like he's kind of thinking like maybe he'll do the trench in another one. But of course, part of the idea of the trench is that from his perspective is that it takes up some real estate, but it's kind of like, you know, especially some root space real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And my thinking is like, well, when you do an Ehler style, then the other thing that you do is that, because like with Zach's style, you still had a lot of open space. So it's like you're standing out in the middle where the growies are, and the growies are planted at foot level, and there's still a lot of room over your head. And I kind of think with an Ehler style greenhouse, then you are standing in a place where your feet go above a trench that's about 4 feet deep below your feet.
Mm-hmm.
And you're standing on these wooden planks. And then there's like a raised bed that comes up about chest height, and that's where your growies are. The total amount of air space in there is much, much less. And so you've got the trench, which is an important component, plus less air in there, which I think is another really important component. And Zax didn't have either of those.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it'd be interesting. It'd be a really interesting podcast to have Zach on to talk, you know, just about that, because I think the benefits of something like that far outweigh any of the negatives. But I can also tell you that Zach is definitely a student of the game, and he's an innovator. So he's always looking for ways to improve the design, the building, and so forth. He actually talked about, just this last year of ways that they have automated, you know, stuffing some of the bags, like the earth berm, the greenhouses that are kind of built into the ground, the ways that they stuff the bags, it just rapidly increases, the efficiency, and it takes a lot less time to build them now and less manual labor. So I'm sure he'll take seriously some of your design considerations, and I know that Zach's a fan of Ayler's work as well. So he's constantly innovating, trying to build make these things better and better. So it would probably be a really interesting podcast to get him on one day to talk about that.
Well, and possibly. Now, I got to say, there's one thing about Zach. Yeah, and I don't know how old he is. He's got to be in his early 20s, is my guess. But I know that I was talking to somebody at the event, and I was saying, you know what? I wish Zach was my kid, because I would totally groove on being able to say, I am proud of my son. I mean, look what he's done.
Yeah.
And it's like, granted, I don't agree with a lot of the stuff that he's doing. And he and I have this conversation a lot where it's like, I'm not a greenhouse guy. I think greenhouses are not a good idea. And, of course, it's like he is the greenhouse guy. And he does such a good job in the greenhouse space. And he's got such a passion for ecosystems, whereas most people, it's like, you know, they're going to plant things in rows. So there's so much where he is so very advanced. I think that it would be like – and he's so young. He's so incredibly young. That it's like, yeah, I wish he was my son. I could say, look at my boy and what he's accomplished and what he's done. That would be really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, maybe you can adopt him. He probably want to be his family. No, I think Zach is 24, if I'm not mistaken. So, yeah, for a guy to have that proficiency of skill sets and that much knowledge at such a young age is really impressive.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so now here's a wild thing that overall $40,000 for that structure, that's like put a stitch in my side. Like, really, it's not even very big.
Well, I want to be very careful what I say here, because I could be talking out of my derriere here. I thought I remember him saying that number, and to me it seemed, you know, for all the fact that you're also, it's basically a house and a greenhouse in one. And that you can take a zone 3 climate like Bozeman and make it zone 7 or zone 6, and have a place to live, and have a much smaller mortgage payment probably than if you bought a traditional house and not have a greenhouse. You know, to me, there was a lot of value there. I might be slightly off on the numbers, so I would encourage anybody who's interested to, you know, contact Zach directly. I think he's at perpetualgreengardens.com is the website, and get a quote from him directly, because I could have misinterpreted or, you know, and there's obviously lots of variables, so just want to give that caveat.
Okay. All right. So, and then there was a big surprise when we got to the big greenhouse, the one that's the old greenhouse, and we walked up, and so this is for this is for Zach's mentor, and there were a few people waiting for us when we arrived, so including Zach's mentor and some of the people that Zach works with in that greenhouse. And there, sitting on a table in front of the greenhouse, waiting patiently, was Mike Ayler.
Yes, the one and only.
And which is weird, because anytime Mike comes to Montana, he calls me up. And it's like, but he never called me. So he said, I wanted to surprise you. So it was like, I was really surprised. Mike, is that, you know, it's like... You can't possibly be Mike, because he didn't call me, and he would have called me. And but nope, there he was, Mike Ayler himself, sitting right there, and so we got to visit with. And Mike was saying that he really enjoys this greenhouse because there's such an ecosystem in there, and it's so amazing and cool. And he's he's so impressed by so much of the things that, that they've done with this greenhouse.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this greenhouse doesn't have any of Ehlers' designs either, although both greenhouses were slightly embedded in the ground, just a little bit. Like maybe the ground level in the greenhouse is probably about a foot lower than the ground level outdoors.
Well, actually, you know, I think I thought it was like 5 or 6 feet. It's a little bit of an optical illusion because of the way the roof slopes down. But I thought that the guy had said that this is like 6 feet in the ground. I might have misunderstood him or misquoted him. But if you look at the way, you know, part of it too is one of the advances they use is they use a special kind of greenhouse cover. I think it's Solex is what it's called, and Zach could elaborate more on that. I think he's a distributor for them, but it actually diffuses light. So, like, to the point where if you actually, you know, put a laser beam on top of it, it would diffuse in a broad spectrum underneath. And so it's designed to get, you know, even the corners of the greenhouse that aren't directly in the sunlight still have those areas get light. So it's kind of, that's another advancement in the technology that I thought was kind of interesting when he discussed that. But anyway, I think it was deeper than that, Paul, but I could be wrong.
Okay, so I think on Zach's new greenhouse, about a foot would be my guess. But in that older one, okay, I could see the possibility of it being deeper, because the ceiling was crazy high, and I'm thinking about like what I saw on the outside and what I saw on the inside, and it does seem like there wasn't a lot of glass for the 4 or 5 feet or so, something like that.
Yeah.
And then it starts being more glass, so it could have been deeper with the older one. So I saw 6 frogs. And there were different species of frogs. Some were very brightly colored, and some were like, you know, looking like normal frogs, and which is kind of cool in March in Montana.
Yeah.
And the frogs were, you know, singing for us and stuff, and it's a beautiful spot. It's just a real pretty thing that they had going on in there. It was fun. But at the same time, it's like it was probably about 16 feet by 30 feet, something like that. So not a massive greenhouse like professional growers have, but, you know, a biggish greenhouse. And I kind of got the impression that a fair amount of work goes into keeping it awesome. So, which to me is kind of like part of what comes with greenhouses is a lot of work.
Yeah, there's definitely work involved. I just think, you know, I understand. I remember having this conversation with you last year in Dayton about greenhouses, and I don't disagree with any of your thoughts on that at all. I just think that as an added, you know, like I said, belt and suspenders approach, I think it's another tool in your toolkit, so to speak, where you can do some pretty cool things, particularly in a cold climate, and maybe start things earlier. I think it's a good hedge in case you ever have that one year where the weather is crazy and, you know, your crop gets wiped out. I think it's a good hedge against that. And I think, you know, if you're interested in that kind of thing, I think his designs are, you know, state of the art.
So, I think that's all I've got to say about, I guess the whole thing. I feel like I'm pretty much all done. Do you have anything else to add in for all of Sep's visit to the United States?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I think we've hashed it out pretty good. The one thing I would just reiterate again is that we will be coming out with more specifics on the certification. That'll be coming shortly. I want to thank all the people that came and helped support the event. You know, as you brought up, there are some great things about it. There were some things that leave a lot to be desired, weren't perfect, that we're going to try to fix. But overall, when you get the chance to interact with a master like that, it's a great opportunity to do it. And I think... But to your point, we're going to come out with specifics on the certification, and I think we're also going to talk real long and hard about the types of events we do. Maybe have a master class that's with SEP, and then maybe some of the more fundamental stuff, the blocking and tackling, we maybe use SEP-certified instructors, which will bring the cost down, actually, and also avoid a situation where you've got Paul Wheaton, who's really knowledgeable and, you know, has a lot of knowledge and is really advanced in this kind of stuff, versus somebody who, you know, maybe just saw a SEP video on YouTube for the first time and is, you know, starting at ground zero. Maybe it's not maybe we should break that up and not have both of those people in the same workshop, because there's going to be different expectation levels, different knowledge and experience levels. So we're going to talk through all that in a lot of detail, and there'll be a lot of interesting stuff coming out to address those issues in the next few weeks.
So this is probably a good time to point out that on the forums of Permies.com, I think we now have more than 100 forums, and we've broken them up into sections. So the first section is Growies, and so there is a permaculture forum there. So I'm trying to think about, like, when the time comes that you have the information about the Holzer certification, where to post it at Permies so people can find it. And it's like, so we have a forum called Permaculture Design, and I think that's in the Living section.
Uh-huh.
I think. I'm not sure, but definitely find the one called Permaculture Design, and I think that's the place to post the stuff about Holzer certification.
Okay.
And so I think it's entirely – I think it would be a powerfully coveted thing, because there are differences between the Holzer approach and the Mollison approach. And so, I've taken a PDC. I'm a certified permaculture designer, and so I can, you know, throw the word permaculture around willy nilly however I want and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been officialed about as far as you can get. Now PRI now has their certified instructor stuff, which apparently has a little bit more. Something or another to it.
Yeah, I know about that.
I know Neil Bertrando is currently working on getting that. I know that Owen Hablitzel already has it. I think that there are 5 people in the United States that are PRI certified instructors right now. So that's a pretty heavy duty thing. But I think getting the Holzer certification is something that would also have a different flavor of weight to it. And I think that there's a lot of people that when seeking a consultant or an instructor or whatever, that they would they would like that. They would, like, they'll watch the Holzer videos and they'll say, I want some of that. And so then I think that that they would then want to call one of the Holzer folks, as opposed to, like, if they watch Jeff Lawton's videos about the food forest, for example. I think the food forest video is still his best. What an excellent video that is. Then I would think that somebody would be like, oh, I want to call in somebody that's certified in that stuff. Plus, I think the Holzer certification will probably – I think the Holzer – being Holzer certified, I think, will probably mean about 10 times more than having completed a PDC. Because a PDC is something where it's like, this is some pretty basic stuff.
Yeah.
Some pretty general things. They kind of teach a PDC to the people that haven't read any of the books or anything.
Yeah, it's an introduction. It's an introduction. There's great information, to be sure, but it's an introduction. And, you know, you're also talking for the Holzer certification. It's going to be, you know, over double the time amount. I mean, the PDC is, what, 12 days? You know, it would be almost three times.
14 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's going to be much more detailed, and I think there'll be much more specifics on some of the things that SEP is really known for, such as, you know, getting ponds and lakes to seal in virtually any kind of soil, dam creation. You know, that whole toolkit of lake and pond building and waterworks is going to be a big part of it.
Right. So in the PDC, people will talk about building ponds, but I think for Holzer certification, it's like you will have to have built a pond.
Yes.
And so I think that, you know, that's an order of magnitude difference right there.
Yeah, or at least been on a project, actively engaged in, you know, a project where you are building upon. Like, maybe SEP is leading the construction, but you're an integral part and you're there and you're watching it and you're, you know, there's going to be a level of proficiency that we'll come up with that shows that you've, you know, you're not just an amateur. You understand the fundamentals.
Right, right, something like that.
As Seth often says, you know, it's. I might have used this analogy yesterday, but, you know, just because you've, you know, purchased a, a musical instrument doesn't mean you're proficient in playing that musical instrument. It takes time and practice and active experience. So the Holzer certification will be far beyond a typical PDC, but it also, you know, there's also practical experience that's going to come with that that's going to take you to the next level. So, but it's definitely a, you know, it'll definitely be a recognizable step on your road up.
All right. Okay, I think we're done.
Hey, we got through it.
Man, that was long. All right, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about the mighty, the glorious, the amazing Sepp Holzer, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.